Welcome to Catholic Stuff You Should Know, the J10 Initiative.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Father John.
Father Sean.
Here we are at one of our, 25 different recording locations.
Studios.
So we're at Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church, located just off of Evans and Santa Fe. I joke that Father Brian Larkin, who's on sabbatical, never leaves this kind of sector of the city, but you kind of get out. Sometimes you come up to me.
But the thing
is, in the big, scary city.
Who, me or Father Brian?
You. He doesn't.
I do get up to you. We recorded there the last couple of times. I will say, though, Father Brian is currently west of Santa Fe.
He is. He's on sabbatical, and he's living the dream. What do you think of everybody asking, how's Father Sean doing?
That's actually died down. I don't know.
Okay.
So, but yeah, people are still asking, like, oh my gosh, how's it been with Father Brian being gone? I'm like, well, I'm here, aren't I? Like,
yeah.
This parish is still here. Nothing's blown up.
It seems like he's doing well. I don't know.
Yeah, I think he's definitely doing well.
No, not him, you.
Oh,
I don't care how he's doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm doing great. I'm loving it in many ways. It's hard. It's hard being in charge. Father Brian once talked about, I love this phrase, he said decision fatigue. I'm like, that's a good way to describe it. Like,
yeah,
you just get tired of, like, why do I have to make all the decisions? And certainly there's certain people who come to you of just like, yeah, you don't need to come, just like, make that decision yourself. Like, you don't need me to make that for you. And then there's other times where it's like, wow, this is a really big decision that has consequences, you know, based on what you do, what you don't do. So,
yeah, I can't say I can, like, understand that phrase. I know I hear companions talk about decision fatigue.
Yeah, but you're so choleric.
I get fatigued in other ways, usually from not asserting my will all the time.
Yes.
That's a joke.
Yes.
You're not supposed to agree with that.
No, but it's kind of true.
I'm just joking.
If you're not leading it was like on the Colorado Trail when we're backpacking. It's like there's four cholerics just butting heads of, like, who's going to speak first? Who's going to take leadership? I loved it. It was awesome.
It was the most four choleric dudes ever, and it worked. It was amazing.
It did.
So it is though. It's a lot. Well, speaking of that, I am happy to announce that I am arriving at a final manuscript of the Colorado Trail book.
Woo, that's great.
So there will be many podcasts, I'm sure, that you guys will be bored to tears with as this thing comes together. I signed a contract with a publisher. And so we're hoping that this thing moves forward. I am absolutely stoked, as they say.
Because you mentioned me in the book, can I get a free copy?
We'll see. Maybe a discounted copy. So you are mentioned in the book. There are certain, many, I'm trying to figure out how to do characters.
Mm-hmm.
Because you obviously have the four guys who hiked the whole Colorado Trail. If you're not familiar with this, I've talked about this in the past, but in the summer of 2 summers ago. Anyways, doesn't matter. I did a through hike of the Colorado Trail, which is a 468 mile trail that runs from Denver to Durango. It goes horizontally through the mountains. And then wrote a book based on 20 years of climbing and just experience in the backcountry. And the book is really about rediscovering God and creation and our humanity as well, and how that's all centered around the fundamental interpretive key of the Christian life, which is the incarnation, which draws all three of them together. And so the narrative goes through the entire story, and then each day is a letter from the trail. It's modeled after Romano Guardini's letters from Lake Como, and tells the story of the trail, but then also kind of does a deep dive into a theological or philosophical point as popularly as possible written. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So that's anyways, great. You'll see my limitations there as a writer, but somebody thinks it's worthy of becoming a book. So I'm absolutely thrilled. Was working that's on great. It all morning. I've been working on it all weekend. I read it cover to cover last weekend.
Mm.
Took me 5 hours.
And it's how many pages on the computer?
It's like 140 single spaced.
Okay.
But then single spacing's tricky because you got different things. It's probably about 200 pages total. It's like 70,000 words.
Great.
So it's not a monster book. It's bite sizes because every day is a letter, 4 or 5 pages.
Yeah. That's great. So your last book you wrote, just out of curiosity, your last book, a lot of authors will they'll donate their, like, whatever they make. I mean, you make like what, $50 in your whole life or whatever.
Yeah.
Do you donate that to a cause? And
the last book, I donated all of the proceeds to Patris Corde, which mm-hmm. is a hermitage retreat center that we, our friends, have founded, and we've been working with them. And I just got a text from John Ryan actually this morning. They got their first check, so they got the $35 or whatever. No, it's usually an author makes about 10-12% on each copy sold. And so I signed that one off. I'm currently with the companions trying to figure out what to do with the next book, because it's obviously going to be a bestseller, and it's just going to, you know, be on the New York Times list. And it will obviously, with the way we do companions, we have these things called the gratis account. So you kind of put money like this that comes on the side into a charity account. The question is how to do that right. I'm trying to figure that out. So I haven't decided if I'm going to just sign it off completely to something, or if I'm going to take it and then distribute it myself.
Our Lady of Lourdes Catholic Church is a nonprofit. We'd be happy to receive your donations.
Okay, we'll see. I'll pray about that, as they say.
That's
so
great.
So yeah, I'm really, really excited about it. You are certainly featured in the story, but that goes back to the thing earlier that kicked all this off, which is how to do characters, because you don't want to have too many where you're like, who are all these people you're talking about? Because the trail, we had four main guys do the whole thing, and then different groups came, each section, including the group you brought. And so basically I've decided that for the sake of keeping certain people anonymous because they did ridiculous things, want to protect their good name, that I've each group just is designated usually by the most ridiculous character. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine who that is in your group. and then kind of creating this kind of literary profile of the group based on their ridiculousness. But you certainly tie in to it directly at several points, and especially at the end, because the story is also a story of our hiking of the Colorado 14ers and finishing together, which kind of comes in the epilogue.
Awesome.
So right up to last fall.
Great.
Yeah. So I'm really, really excited about it. And I'm also ready to be done with it, because books are, as they say, never finished. They're abandoned. Mm. So at a certain point, you just have to...
Would you write a sequel to it?
In what sense?
Well, if you say no, then maybe I'll write the sequel to it.
Sure, you should write the sequel.
I don't know. Letters from the Benedict 100.
There you go. I like it. Yeah, we could do a ski version. We could do a biking version. Yes. We just have to kind of create a...
In the Sean Conn Peloton.
You might write memoirs of a failed 11-year bet. That might be an interesting study.
Yes, that could be interesting, but the bet's not over yet. So.
The bet's not over yet, folks.
We still have a decade.
Yeah.
I'm not even 30 yet. Listen up.
I know. Coming up on it, though. Yeah, so that would be great. I won't belabor this, but it's just been, these things are like born out of your experience. And so it's never like, I'm going to sit down and write a book. It's just like, you and I are sharing life, having adventure. God inspires certain graces and kind of intuitions. And then you start writing. And then it just kind of comes together.
How do you balance that? Like, as in, certainly this is a love for you, which is helpful. It might be even recreation for you, recreation for you. It recreates you. But like, how do you balance that in the midst of like planning a semester, planning classes every, you know, 5 days or whatever of, oh, I got to plan for this week's lectures now. And then on top of that, taking an hour a week, or how much time, and just taking back and saying, no, I want to write this. This is good for me.
Yeah. It's, there are certain kinds of work that are really life-giving, but really exhausting. And it sounds strange to pair those together. I basically do this in all my free time. Hmm. So not all my free time. We do fun stuff. We ski together and do different things. But writing is best done in 4-hour blocks, I find. Mm. And I've taken consolation talking to other friends and people who are writers, like Megan Nix, who we're going to interview next month. We're super pumped about that, who wrote a book, Remedies of Sorrow. She's going to be on the podcast. She said it took her 7 years to write this book. And she's an amazing writer. Mm. I am just really, really kind of moved by her ability. And again, we'll talk more about that. So we're going to have a real author on the podcast, not one of these kind of
great
jamokes who somehow got a second book on its way towards publication. So So anyways, stay tuned on that, both with Megan Nix, and then we'll keep you posted. It'll probably be a year or so. It'll be a lot longer than I expect before this thing actually comes out in book form. So,
sure. Well, congratulations at least.
Thanks, buddy. I appreciate it. But getting into the topic here, because we are a bit limited on time today, so we're going to probably do two shorter ones. We always say that, then they go the same length. But because a friend of ours, his pastor, is in the hospital, and I gotta get up there to help out with a mass. Got to put a homily together on the drive. No, I'm just joking. Kind of.
I'll give you a homily if you want.
I'd love your homily, actually. Maybe on the break we can take an espresso and you can give me a homily. But
deal.
I want to start this topic, which is called eschatology and utopia. So kind of big words. It's like, what is he talking about? But I just want to start with, on Friday night, I finally watched the movie Oppenheimer.
Nice.
Have you seen it?
I have not. I have not seen a movie in a long time.
So people who are listening to the podcast are like, oh, thank God he's talking to Father Sean and not Deacon Jacob
yes.
Because he is a Christopher Nolan guy to the max. But Oppenheimer was incredible. It's a biographical story, so it's a very different kind of movie for Nolan, but he is just so masterful and so brilliant. But I've been thinking about it all week, and the movie has really kind of carried into my consciousness because it ties into these themes of eschatology and utopia, or better put, dystopia, the opposite of utopia.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, dystopian novels like Brave New World, Hunger Games, 1984, those books all, like, whenever you strive for a utopia, you always fall back into a dystopia.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And eschatology is the study of the last things. Eschatos is the Greek word for the end. So what is man's end? What is the point of history and the meaningfulness of things? And what this movie communicated to me was how powerful the creation of the nuclear weapon was in this moment, in this post World War II moment in the world, which then kicked off the Cold War. And I don't want to go into detail on this because it's not the point of the podcast, but I just have to say it. Like, when Francis Bacon lays out a vision for how science is to work, manipulating nature and controlling and giving man the capacity for power, we followed its logical process to its conclusion, which is Oppenheimer and the creation of the nuclear weapon. And then the world forever being changed by it. And Nolan is kind of catching that in a very, very powerful way. So it's almost like it's the untethering of science from metaphysics. The whole ethical sphere kind of falls behind, even gets collapsed. And then all of a sudden we're impelled almost like by this deterministic fate type mentality to create this thing. And then we figure out, oh crap, now what do we do? And then the whole drama plays out in terms of the political sphere and the Russians and the Germans and the whole bit. And so it's a very interesting movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe I should watch it.
I'd recommend it.
Great.
You know what else you should do? Read Utopia by St. Thomas More. Have you ever read this book?
I haven't even heard of it, actually. I don't know who wrote that.
Do you know St. Thomas More?
I do know St. Thomas More.
What do you know about St. Thomas More?
That he was a chancellor. Is that what they're called? Essentially like a lawyer, right?
Yep.
In England under King Henry VIII, right?
Yep. And
King Henry VIII put him to death, I think by decapitation. He was beheaded, if I remember correctly, because St. Thomas More stood up for marriage. King Henry VIII wanted a divorce. He went to the Pope. The Pope said no. So King Henry VIII said, well, I'm just going to start my own church. And Thomas More said, no, this is not okay. I'm going to defend our Catholic faith, the Catholic faith. And then King Henry VIII said, fine, I'm going to put you to death, and beheaded him.
That's right. 16th century martyr. St. Thomas More was born in 1478. Went to Oxford, kind of very noble family. Became an MP and an under-sheriff of London. He was the envoy to Flanders, where he wrote a book called Utopia, and he finished it in the year 1516.
Okay.
Now, what happens in the world in 1517?
95 theses are posted on the door of Wittenberg. Is that what it's called? By Martin Luther.
That's right. Exactly. You studied your history. So several years after that, 1532, St. Thomas More is going to resign. He's going to be charged with high treason for the reasons you just stipulated. And then he will be beheaded in 1535. Hmm. His canonization was 400 years later.
Oh, wow.
This is a crazy book. If you let's say you're meeting with, like, I better watch it. I almost said Walking with Purpose, or
it's funny because I'm actually going to go talk to them on Tuesday.
Well, I'm in trouble with homeschool moms, Walking with Purpose. I'm sorry, Mary Machado. I have to publicly apologize. I love all of these groups, and I got to just watch my mouth. I just kind of fire these things off. What I mean here is if you were meeting hypothetically with a group of Catholic people. Uh-huh. Who were well-formed, well-intentioned, pure of heart, and you kind of covered up the name on this book, the author's name, and you read this book, they'd be like, what the hell are we reading?
Right.
It's written by a saint.
Yeah.
And it's a very strange piece of literature. Hmm. St. Thomas More creates...
Is it a novel?
It's a novel, yep. It's this kind of description of an island society called Utopia. Uh-huh. Utopia means what? Well, in Greek, you topos, nowhere.
Oh, interesting. No place.
Yeah. No place. Yep. So he's talking about how to create a perfectly ordered society. He is working out of Plato's Republic very clearly. So that's kind of really the first great masterpiece that we see in Western civilization where somebody articulates what does a perfect society look like? Mm. Okay. St. Thomas More takes up this theme and kind of follows it, but he creates this kind of literature, this literary form called Utopia, from which, as you mentioned earlier, is going to follow dystopian literature as well, right? Dystopia will follow in like the 19th and 20th century in particular. So he kind of creates this thing. And again, the point of this is not to kind of unpack Thomas More's book, because I think it's very kind of particular and it needs to be read. It's certainly worth reading. It's pretty short. It's only 100 pages. But I mean, imagine, well, I should say before we go into this, like, why does this matter? Why does the idea of creating a perfect society matter? Because the way society operates and the culture that we find ourselves in is essential for how we flourish or don't flourish as human beings. Mm-hmm. We're so damn individualistic as Americans. Mm-hmm. We think that, oh, society doesn't matter. It matters.
Yeah.
The legislation that's being passed in the state of Colorado has radically changed the society that we live in. And this was not the state I lived in before I went to Rome in 2015. It's completely different. It's certainly not the one that I grew up in the 90s and that, you know, you obviously grew up in as well. So the question of society, the question of the politics, or the Greek word here is polis, the community, really matters, because you're not just, and I'm not just, an individual on this kind of self quest for authentication and fulfillment that really doesn't involve other people. Maybe it does accidentally. Mm-hmm. I'll marry one that'll probably involve them, but this is how we think about things. Mm-hmm. That's really that's fundamentally problematic.
Yeah, I mean, we think of it, as we've talked about in the past, bagging 14ers, right? What did you once say? There's more to life than boozy shakes and Tiger King, right? But we like the pleasures of life and conquering things, right? The word conquering comes to mind. I'm just like, I'm going to go and ski as many days as I can this year, move to the mountains and be a ski bum. I find it really fascinating, the whole work from home culture, because downtown is empty right now. Urban life is empty because no one works in big office buildings anymore. Where are they going? They're moving out to the, you know, smaller towns. They're living in vans, you know, van life, so that they can go and live their best life.
Yeah. Yeah. The boozy shakes and Tiger Kings. That's funny. That's probably the most powerful line I've ever said of 5 years of seminary work. I said that to it, not your deacon class, but another deacon class who were rather cheeky bunch and they needed to get checked. Yeah, priestly life is more than just boozy shakes and Tiger King, which I hope they have all moved beyond that at this point. But at the time, it was still rather questionable.
It was COVID.
So St. Thomas More creates an island, a fictitious island. And the story is, it's interesting because it's 1516. The story takes place in Flanders, okay? And so it's not in England, it's on the continent. And he's talking to a guy. He meets a friend of a friend, and they have this conversation. And the guy that Thomas More is talking to has been to this island. He's traveled all over the world. He finds this mythical place called Utopia. And the whole book is the description of how they live. Mm. Now, what's interesting is there's certain aspects of it that would make us uncomfortable, such as there's no private property, which that sounds like what?
Communism.
Exactly. So it is this kind of socialistic vision of reality, but it's also grounded in human nature. It's steeped in family life, community life. It's agrarian. It's self-sustaining. It's educated. It's a very interesting society, but it's also not explicitly Christian. Christian missionaries come to this island, and it talks about how the utopians are open to the faith and a number of them convert, but there's this baseline notion of religious freedom, and that sounds like what?
America.
Yeah, exactly. Liberalism.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. So there's this kind of like anybody can kind of do anything they want religiously, and you can kind of practice different things. And in the 16th century, this is like, these are very radical ideas.
Yeah.
And this is, and at the end of the book, he does this kind of quick little kind of turn of hand where he says, now, I don't really agree with everything that this guy had to say, but, you know, we don't really have time to discuss that. Mm. So Thomas More doesn't kind of tell you this is what it is. So is this fictitious? Is this paradoxical? Like, what is this a caricature or is this real? Is this real political theory? Mm. It's hard to know.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting thought.
That is super interesting. And what did you say it's based off of? Plato's what?
Republic.
Okay. Interesting. Because part of Plato, right, is he writes from Socrates. So that's interesting of like, there's like the question in Plato is just like, is he writing as Socrates so that he can't be put to death by the state, right? Of like, if this government comes and just like, what, do you actually believe these things? Is this a theory? Are you just like, you know, and he's just like, oh no, I don't believe that. Socrates, my character in my book, believes that.
Right.
Which is really interesting.
Right. So we're asking ourselves like, what do these guys actually believe when it comes to an ideal state and to a perfect society? Mm. Now, stepping back from this for a second, we have to understand that there is to write this in the 16th century, and he's friends with Erasmus and these other guys who are like kind of Renaissance influenced. So they're moving beyond a medieval understanding of the world, of a feudalistic society, agrarian society. What's happening is we're moving into, we're about to hit a series of revolutions, theological one in the Reformation, philosophical revolution that happens with the Enlightenment, certainly in the Industrial Revolution, scientific, technological, all these things that have led to this world that we live in today and that we presume as normative, but they're kind of laying some of the groundwork for this. So I think that St. Thomas More is writing very deeply, and he's thinking really deeply. He's also kind of prophetic in a way. He sees where modernity is going. And one of the hallmarks of modernity is that it desires utopia. That we believe we can create the perfect civilization.
Would you call that like a synthesis as well of like Hegelian of just like we're always progress, right? We're always just progressing towards the utopian, or is that a little different?
Oh, I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, progress is the religion of the modern world.
Yeah.
And we're still living in this kind of progressive religion. I think we did a podcast on this, the Religion of the Day, a couple months ago.
Yeah, that's so, right.
You remember that?
Yeah.
University of Mary put that out. Jim Shea, it's like a awesome little book. So progressivism is the thing that's saying until we accept and support trans rallies for Palestine, which is happening down the street, or did yesterday. I drove past it.
Dang.
We're not actually progressing towards utopia. And this is where we have to introduce the second concept, which is eschatology. So eschatology, did we study eschatology together?
Yes.
Okay. So describe it for me again. I gave a basic definition, but what is it exactly?
Eschatology. So the Greek word eschaton or eschatos means end. So eschatology essentially is a study of the end times, end things, the last things, which we could also phrase as death, judgment, heaven, and hell. All of us we'll die. After we die, we will be judged. And based on that judgment, our particular judgment, we will either go to heaven or hell. Everyone in purgatory goes to heaven eventually.
Okay. Now, what I'm interested in, I agree with everything you just said. Eschatology, also, the way we think about the end affects what we do in the middle today, right? Where we came from, the beginning.
Protology,
where we're going at the end.
Eschatology
affects the meaningfulness of the present moment.
Right.
It depends, it determines how we interpret reality, what we value, how we build out a culture. So I'm thinking about, I'm taking my nephew, Micah, skiing tomorrow. So we got these little certificates that they got for one adventure day. He's cashing it. We're skiing tomorrow.
Mook and Rally.
You're going to be a Keystone. We're going to be there. When you see the little 8-year-old not turning and me trying to catch him all the time, that's when you'll see us.
Great.
Micah is part of a sports league that's here local to your parish. Mm-hmm. Now, it's awesome. Like Frasati Sports and is that the one Ryan runs?
Yeah,
right. I mean, but what is it? It's a small little subset of society that's like, these are the things that we value as families, as Catholics. These are the principles that we want to determine how our kids engage in competition, how they think about sports, how it forms their humanity. Mm. So it's a series of values. It's a set of that.
Yeah.
Were it not for the protological and eschatological foundations that they have a sense of, these are created beings with limitations and dependence. They have to learn and understand that they're not the center of the universe, that it's not just about making money. It's not just about prowess and competition. It's not just about power. That they're going somewhere, that the end matters, that they're accountable for their actions, that there will be a final judgment, that there is justice in the end. These things determine how you set up a sports league for 8-year-olds. Mm-hmm. They really do.
Yeah.
Or how you do whatever rally you take your kids down to downtown or put them into, public school and the way we educate in ideology. It's all affected by that.
Correct, yeah.
So the point here is to say that the end matters. Eschatology affects history. Mm. We can't not think like that.
Yeah.
One of the challenges in the modern world is that in this utopia, this comes back to that this utopian thing, is that when you secularize your mentality, your vision of things, so secularizing means like God is bracketed. He's not a part of the reality. It's just this world. When you do that, you're automatically looking to create the utopian world within this world. Mm. And that's the killer. That's the problem, is that we actually think we can create utopia on Earth if we just get the right political, economic, social factors in play, and then everything's fine.
Yeah.
And that's what's we're ultimately destroying ourselves constantly. This is the pattern and the cycle within the last few centuries.
Even in the Catholic Church is what you're saying.
We can be. We can do that, yeah. We look for a utopian church. Give me the perfect liturgy. Give me the perfect culture. Give me the perfect bishops. And again, it doesn't justify the mess of things and the lack of leadership and the complexity and the making of a mess that's happening right now. Mm-hmm. These things are real. But also, it's like, are we utopian in the way we think about the world?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would say I can struggle with that in the church because I think my temptation, and I think, right, this is the idea of the Benedict option in a certain sense as well, of like, if I just have the right people around me, the right community, and for parents, of like, if I just have my kids be in the right thing, the right environment, the right place, then they'll all be priests and they'll all be nuns. And like, that's what I want for my kids or whatever, right? Like, we can get in these thinking habits of like a perfect world. And as long as we do everything right, but there's always freedom. Like, we forget about that. And people can choose not to follow. All right. You mentioned you need a homily for tonight.
So, got it. Good. Go. Go.
This is part of what I preached about today, but, Larry Chapp's book, Cruciformity, or Confession of a Catholic Worker, but he talks about cruciformity. And I think this is what it goes back to. Like, do we live that cruciformity life? And, I was reading part of that this morning, because one of the things, he used the word penultimate, which I just loved. He goes, if we focus too much on the penultimate things, which, right, penultimate means second to last as opposed to last. If we focus on the penultimate things as opposed to the final end, right, so this is like when we focus on power and wealth in the world as opposed to heaven, then like everything gets mixed up. You have to have the final end, the eschatology at its proper place. Otherwise we get focused on the wrong things. I just love the phrasing of that. Don't focus on the penultimate things.
Makes me think of Phil Leggett, who's the great Tour de France.
And Bob Roll.
Bob Roll and Phil Leggett. But Phil Leggett's always talking about the penultimate ride of the Tour de France with his great British accent. Yeah, because the eschatos, the last thing, the end, is God.
Right.
It's not heaven. It's God. That's our end. So the whole purpose, so I'm going to, on the break, I need an espresso.
Great.
Okay. So we're going to go have an espresso. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, and then why am I doing that? So I get caffeinated so that I, what? So I have a good mass, so I, you can give me a good homily. So that what? So that I can go to bed tonight and feel like I gave myself, made a gift of myself to the Lord today. Boom, boom, boom. All these reasons and intentions and doing things. Mm-hmm. There's always an end to every human action, but the ultimate end is God. Mm-hmm. And so anything penultimate that severs us from God is going to affect and misdirect and misguide my course of action. And so eschatology, sounding like this super lofty thing that we read about in Dante, and it's just kind of like this kind of medieval vestige of like demons poking people in fire and in heaven, where, you know, high school kid asked one of my seminarians, he's like, please don't tell me that heaven is just sitting in church all day, right? That's a great question.
Great question. I love
it. It's a great question, but this is how we think about the end times.
Right.
And people like mock it because they think that if you're Christian and you live for this eschatological reality, which means the next life, then you don't actually get to live this life, right? Mm-hmm. I'd rather laugh with the sinners than die with the saints, or right. cry with the saints. Billy Joel, you know right. that song? Do you know who Billy Joel is?
I do know who Billy Joel is.
Very good, right? Because sinning is much more fun. Only the good die young. Mm-hmm. It's like, yep, that one's going to be on repeat in hell for mm-hmm. sure. Right yeah. after, what is it? Is it Frank Sinatra's I Did It My Way?
I Did It My Way.
Or yeah. Dean Martin. I don't know. What one of the Rat Pack. So there's a sense that like, if you tether your life to an eschatological reality, then you don't get to enjoy this life, mm-hmm. right? I remember being on top of a 14er years ago and this Hanyak came up to me and I could just tell by the stupid grin on his face. I was like, this is not a conversation I'm going to enjoy. And he's like, what church are you a part of? Mm. And I said, the Catholic Church. And he said, I'm a part of the First Church of the Rockies. And I was like, good for you. I didn't say that, but I wanted to be like, good for you. And he goes, it's nice that you guys live for heaven, but you know what? I'm living for life right now because this is heaven. Mm. And even when you go to our cathedral, there's a Jack Kerouac mural on the side of the building across from the cathedral. Have you mm-hmm. seen that?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's all about loving people. And if you do that, you're in heaven now, something like that, some line from Kerouac. And it's a statement against the cathedral.
Right.
Of like, you people are trying to store up your treasures in heaven for this mythical place. And it actually doesn't exist. And the rest of us are down here and we're actually loving mm-hmm. people. We're actually taking care of them.
Yeah.
And it's like, this is crazy.
Yeah.
This is the secularization that's happened. But let me tell you something. Go back to Oppenheimer. You create a nuclear weapon, and all of a sudden you start asking yourself questions about the end times mm-hmm. because you now have the capacity to destroy the earth,
right.
to literally destroy the world. And the one thing that that guy, that Hanyak up on the mountain forgets is like, and this ties well to your homily on cruciformity, it's like, well, death is something you can just avoid. Mm. Sickness is something you can avoid, I guess, or you think you can because you're modern, but then you're going to die.
Right.
And even Heidegger, okay, the philosopher of the last century, is going to say, if you don't live in relationship to death, you're never going to be an authentic Dasein, as he says, right?
Yep, yep.
You're never going to come to truly living a life if you just kind of relegate it, but we live in this bourgeois culture that's just like, yeah, we're, everything's comfortable and we're fine. Yeah, civilization's falling apart. And if you go north of Evans Avenue, you're going to find that people are protesting because they want trans rights under Sharia law in Palestine, and it's anti-Semitic. And I got this homeless guy attacked me yesterday. And it's just like, I'm living precariously off 6th Avenue.
Yeah.
Like, don't tell my mom that. I hope she doesn't listen to this podcast. But I thought this guy was gonna shank me because he just got in my face. He was obviously on some kind of drug. And it's like, yeah, that's great. If you can live in the bubble, you create your little utopia mm-hmm. and pretend like you're never going to die and you're totally fine and you're not actually tortured by your human heart, contrary to what Jeremiah says. That's fine. But I think you're lying to yourself. Mm-hmm. I think you're living in self-deception. Yeah. There has to be something deeper.
Oh, I completely agree. And I think that's interesting that Hanyak on the mountain said, you might be living for heaven, but I'm living for this earth. This is my heaven. It's just interesting because, as you're alluding to, like, it's a denial of that there's suffering in this life. It's a denial of that. Like, this is not heaven. Like, it's not. There's real sufferings, and you can certainly try to deny them all you want and live in the van life and do the whole Alexander Superstramp thing, but it's at the core of it, it's just not fulfilling. We make it fulfilling because we're running from something else, but it's not.
Suffering is something that only human beings can do. All animals feel pain, mm-hmm. but suffering is the question of why. Hmm. When you're suffering, you're asking why. And that's a beautiful thing. It's a terrible thing, but it's a beautiful thing. And that's why Balthasar is so big on that suffering is the way to knowledge of God. Mathein pathein, the Greek, we've talked about that in the past, but it doesn't make sense in light of, unless you bring it to bear on the end. And so this whole kind of contradiction or kind of dialectic between Christians live for the next life, we're really the ones enjoying this life. It's like, okay, maybe. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hand him a copy of The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis and be like, yeah, but you could be in hell right now. Mm. You can be on a mountaintop and be in hell, living in an existential hell, or you could be living in heaven. Mm. So heaven becomes something that comes to bear. It's also, these are real destinations. This is something that's absolutely real.
Yep.
And every great religious tradition in history has meditated on the fact that life does not and cannot be fulfilled in this life, and that there must be something beyond. There's always a sense of that. Only in this kind of secularized modern world do we think that technology, kind of techno-science, can establish for us the fulfillment that we desire in this life, that we can perfect this world, that Elon Musk is going to make it happen, right? Because he's from the future. There's no way he's a real human being from
Starlink.
Right, exactly. So we have to get back to it. This pairing of eschatology and utopia, I read Utopia in the John Cooney Literary Society last month.
Nice.
And then I'm teaching Ratzinger's book here I have in my hand. It's called Church, Ecumenism, and Politics. And he's got a little bitty chapter called Eschatology and Utopia. So once again, it's all stolen. So I'm trying to navigate this. So I'm just going to read 3 points from this, and then I think we'll probably kind of draw this thing to a close.
Great.
Sound good?
Yep. Sounds good.
Okay. He says that in keeping with the first thing to be established, that a literary and philosophical genre, utopia, has had its origins in the humanist philosophy, we have to turn to the Renaissance thinking of Thomas More as its first classical representative. So he's pointing to the book that I just had in my hand. Utopia is the utopian form as a philosophical and literary genre was established by St. Thomas More. Mm. Okay. Utopia became a form of political philosophy that can more exactly be characterized as Platonism with Christian elements. Okay. So it flows out of this is all stuff we've talked about. It flows out of Plato's Republic, and it gives the sense. And he says, it can also be asserted that utopia takes up once again the undertaking that occupied Plato with his construction of the ideal state. It makes clear the presuppositions and aims of utopia in its classical form. Okay. So he goes on and on, and he's explaining this. But why Plato? Why St. Thomas More? What are they trying to articulate here? And this is the question. Do they actually believe in the ideal state that we can actually come to a polis, a community that is so true and living according to wisdom that we can perfect it? Or is it some kind of satire? Hmm. That's the question.
Yeah.
And I don't know. And we had beers and talked this out for a couple hours with the guys, and I don't think any of us really came to the conclusion. Hmm. Is this satirical or not?
Yeah.
Plato's Republic, St. Thomas More's Utopia. But certainly this genre is formed, and then modernity begins in the years and the decades and the centuries following St. Thomas More, and it becomes the preoccupation of man to create the perfect society in this world without God. That's the distinction. Mm. Any thoughts on that?
Which is Marxism, right? That's that's communism, the removal of religion from the society so that you can create some sort of utopian, right? Like religion's the evil thing. I find it interesting. I mean, again, I haven't read Utopia, but you mentioned that the missionaries come and evangelize them. Like it's not Christian society, but they have what we would argue as Christian principles, right?
Yeah, and it at times it looks like Rousseau, you know, was famous for his noble savage, this idea that we're all kind of in a pristine, perfect human nature. It's a denial of the fall, where everything's kind of great, and then we introduce them to civilization. Then they come, then the savage moves to Paris, and we destroy him. Right. You know? Which again, there's some truth in these things. But yeah, so what we're saying here is that Utopia, after Thomas More, becomes a political philosophy that's operative within the metaphysical thinking of modernity. And that comes to bear, or I should say, has implications for how we think about eschatology. Okay. The end times, because we've relegated this kind of Christian notion of an afterlife. And we've said, okay, we're gonna do it all right now. We're gonna build the perfect society. Everything's gonna be kind of great, and we are the ones who can accomplish this. So then Ratzinger says, but then as Christians, we have to bring to bear the fact that eschatology is part of the statement of faith. All right. He says the resurrection of Jesus is proclaimed as a resurrection of the dead, eternal life, and the kingdom of God. Jesus is constantly talking about the kingdom of God. What does he mean by that? The kingdom of God, or the kingdom of heaven, is him.
Is himself, right?
Right. It's himself. But heaven is described as the kingdom, as, and not utopia, nowhere, but a person.
It's
where Christ is. And so going back to the Hanyak on the mountain, it's like he's trying to build his utopia in this life. He sees me building my utopia in the next life, but that's a misreading of the Christian claim. It's that, no, actually, this isn't utopos. This is logos. This is Christ. This is a person. This is a location. This is a place and in a person that's more meaningful, more powerful, more real than anything we're looking at right now, anything that we see or we're sensing. And that's what eschatology is centered on. This is what Ratzinger says. Eschatology is rather a product of the fusion of Christian faith with the Greek search for the logos, the reason that holds things together. It means the endeavor to think out the inner logic of the statements of Christian faith about eternal life, to feel how this logic works on the basis of the internal unity of the entirety of the Christian message about God, the world, and man, and in this way to fit its content in with the idea of man as a meaningful entity. Mm-hmm. All right. So this search and this kind of unfolding of the Christian life is centered in the event of Christ and in his teaching. The first book that we believe was written of the Bible after the death of Christ, and this is within the first decade after his death and resurrection, is?
First Thessalonians,
which is centered on the theme of?
Eschatology,
the parousia, right? The second coming. When is he coming? This is the first thing that preoccupies Christians.
Yeah, that's interesting.
All right? It's not like, oh, we kind of messed up the liturgy. We got to get that back in order. Or like, well, we got to make sure we're morally doing everything right. They're just like, when is he coming back? When is the end of history?
Yeah.
When is the end of time? Because we just had him. And now he's become a life-giving spirit, as St. Paul says. And we just want to live in him. That's where we want to be. That's the eschatological drive in the early church. And I think that's largely been lost, even for Catholics in our modern time.
Right, yeah. Yeah, we don't look at the end times in the, yeah, that's a good analogy of like, we get so focused on, did I do the right thing? Did I celebrate Mass correctly? Did the priest say the right words and stuff? And just like, those are important questions. But if Christ is not with us, then we're missing the point.
Right.
Christ is with you. And when you see that as Mass, like the music no longer matters, the talent of the preaching, the how good the preaching is doesn't matter. Like what matters is that Christ is coming to you and he's dwelling inside you. That's what it means when we say thy kingdom come, that Jesus Christ would reign within us. That's his kingdom coming into you, which I love, right? The kingdom of heaven is at hand, yeah, because Jesus Christ is here with us.
Right, so the eschatological breaking into history happens with the incarnation. God becomes man in Jesus Christ, And all of a sudden, the end of history just broke into the middle of history. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're living in, this kind of tension. Things have been realized in a way, and yet they're unfulfilled.
Yeah, already, but not yet.
So the question we have to ask is, am I living my Catholic faith in the world as a utopian or as an eschatological thinker? Utopia, Ratzinger writes, evokes human action guided by the practical reason. I'm going to figure it out. We're going to figure out how to have the perfect family, have the perfect society, the perfect church, the perfect political world, whatever it might be. Eschatology, he says, is directed towards the receptive patience of faith. So there's something, and again, this isn't St. Thomas More's writing on utopia, because we don't know. Is the satire? We're not totally sure. But there's something about the crazy activistic haste of the modern world that's like, we got to get this right. We got to get this right. We got to figure this out. We got to perfect everything. We got to cure the world of all disease and such and such and this and this and this and this. And it's just like, he's just like, well, if you live eschatologically, you carry and render within yourself a receptive patience. And that's Marian to the core. She's the one who just receives reality and let things be as they are, knowing that Jesus has fulfilled and will fulfill history according to the end, which is the Father. That's the difference. So I think that's just an interesting worth thinking about, right?
Yeah, I like how it was like a receptivity towards faith, because of receptivity, the Marian heart of surrender. It's like the utopian society is, I want to control this. I want to, as you said, like, I use my reason to manipulate, to control, to make it what I want it to be.
Right.
And good Catholics, we can do this, right? Of like, I want my family to look this way and this, and I want all my kids to, you know, to be saints, which is a good thing to hope for, but you can't control it. And you have to just surrender to God's providence, surrender to these things, and, you know, certainly try your best. Don't let your kids make bad decisions, you know, to the best you can, but you also can't control them. Surrender to God's faith, his providence.
Yeah, it's well said. And it's just such a beautiful line. Ratzinger is just the best. I mean, think of just breaking that down a little more slowly. The receptive patience of faith. If we lived with that, I mean, how much more peaceful would my life be?
Yeah.
If it was just simply that, the receptive patience of faith. It begins with receptivity. Patience is a kind of suffering of letting things be, right? I can't control it. I might not have decision fatigue, but I am the least patient man in the companions. Hands down, I'll take it, right? But this is the heart of faith, of Marian faith, as you described well there. And I think that's what we have to get back to. Final point. And this is just kind of tying a couple other things together here. History demands, this is Ratzinger, history demands meaning, but cannot ultimately contain its meaning within itself. So either it is meaningless, or it is brought to fulfillment as itself, outside itself, and has meaning by transcending itself. That is a very interesting insight. Let me read it again. History, so think about your life, your story, your history, demands meaning. So your life demands meaningfulness, right? You're not just an animal vegetating, sensating. You have a rational soul, which means that you are thinking deeply and you're made for meaning. That's we're logos-centered beings. We have to think about meaning. Your story and all of history demands meaning, but cannot ultimately contain meaning within itself. So the meaning, this is the tragic mistake of modernity. We think that history is meaningful in itself. This is the mistake of Oppenheimer, right? This is the falsity of the modern world that thinks that meaning lies in the world itself, that it's just all here. It's just my family is meaningful as I want it to be, my community, my state, my country, my world, whatever it might be. History demands meaning, but it cannot ultimately contain its meaning within itself. It carries meaning, but it comes from a different source. So either it's meaningless, we end up in a kind of nihilism, and techno-nihilism is really dominating the culture we live in right now. I mean, it is everywhere. It's either meaningless or it's brought to fulfillment as itself, outside itself, and has meaning by transcending itself.
Beautiful.
So, in Soma, as the Italians would say, to close it out, what's Ratzinger going to say on Thomas More? Well, he doesn't say it's satire, But I think that Thomas More is fleshing out real things here. There are real things that we can do, real things that we can think differently about to improve and deepen and develop the society that we live in. Mm. We actively work in and with God to establish his kingdom. But it's not this nonsense, let us build the city of God that I'm probably going to sing in about 2 hours at this parish, right? So there's something about the utopian drive in us that Thomas More is putting his finger on. But the idea of a self-enclosed history and world that can create the perfect society, not possible. Mm. Eschatology is like the ceiling of this house blown off and open because God is the ultimate transcending and meaningful source of everything.
Beautiful.
That's all I have to say.
Well, my concluding thought would be just that last point with regards to the meaningfulness of your life is found outside of your life. You know, so when you're struggling with like, what's my purpose in life? And I've made all this money. I've done all this schooling. I'm a doctor now, whatever it is. And I've climbed all the 14ers, right? Like, but I find no meaning in my life. Well, yeah, because the meaningfulness of your life is what we call eccentric, meaning outside of your center. It's located in Christ, in his heart, in his center. You will be more happy the more that you locate your meaningfulness, your worth in the Logos, in
Christ.
That's
it. By giving of ourselves, we actually fulfill ourselves. But you have to squander, you have to give. So, well said. We better wrap this one up because we got another one to do before Mass.
Great.
You got any shout-outs?
Shout-outs. I have one. A guy named Josh Pace. Thanks for coming to Mass the other day. He came over to St. Louis and he said the podcast has been a huge help for him coming back to the faith. So excited to know more about you. Josh, thanks for listening to the podcast, and I'm glad this has helped you bring you back to the faith.
That's great. Beautiful. I do actually want to apologize to Mary Machado and Homeschool Moms. I really did not mean to slam you publicly. And so this is a sincere apology. I'm cleaning up my language for Lent. And thank you for also challenging me because I really appreciate a little, it's not a fraternal correction. It's like maternal correction, mm-hmm. right? Which is good. And paternal because Rick was involved as well. Shout out to Dane Conley, an old friend, Steubenville buddy of my brother's, who reached out, who listens to the podcast. Great guy. He'd be a fun one to have on the podcast. A real character.
Yeah.
And then lastly, another podcast listener, Deacon Nick Connor, came through town and stayed with us at St. Joe's. And Nick, it was great to have you. You're getting ordained for Peoria in May, I think on May 25th. And so we're praying for you. I wish we would have had more time together, but we look forward to having you back as a priest. So I think that's it for round one today.
Great. Thanks for listening, everyone.
CatholicStuffPodcast@gmail.com. Yeah, thank you again for listening. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram. And we will see you next week.
Awesome. God bless, everyone.